From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Harvey has rained down feet of water in Texas, turning the city of Houston into a lake. By the time the skies clear, homes will have suffered an estimated $30 billion worth of damage. The National Flood Insurance Program is supposed to provide a lifeboat to homeowners, but it's already $25 billion in debt, and its congressional reauthorization next month is in doubt. This hour on Point, what should be done with the beleaguered flood insurance program, and how will homeowners pay for all that flood damage? You can join us on air or online. Do you live in a flood zone? Do you have flood insurance? If not, why not? If so, are your premiums manageable? Do you think premiums should be higher? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. NPR will have continuing updates on Harvey and the Texas Gulf Coast, including President Trump's visit to the region throughout the day. Joining me now from Houston is John Burnett, NPR's Southwest correspondent, who's been on the ground in Texas covering Tropical Storm Harvey. John, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Sasha.
So tell us where you are exactly.
Ooh, let's see what I'm seeing. We've been trying to get to a staging area where the so-called Cajun Navy has been bringing their boats to do rescues of people, and we can't get there. We've been driving on U.S. 90. We just crossed Wallaceville Road, the way up northeast Houston, and we have just encountered a lake that wasn't here before. I'm looking at a truck that is submerged. These muddy waters are over the hood. The back window's open, so presumably they got out. The apartment complex to the right, looks like the water is up to the air conditioning units. This is a sight that you see everywhere in Houston now. It's just, words are my business. It's almost indescribable, Sasha. These lagoons, these inland seas have sprung up everywhere.
When we were talking with several people in the Houston area yesterday, some of them were saying there were bands of rain, so some people weren't that affected and some were. But from what you see, this is extremely widespread. Is that what you're getting a sense of?
Yeah, it's definitely widespread. I mean, there are parts of town, for instance, West Houston up by Westheimer, that are still are passable, absolutely. Because, for instance, at the place where the hotel downtown, there are workers that are going home at night and finding a way in. But still, vast parts of this mammoth city are underwater, and people are stuck on islands. I mean, we just passed a convenience store. There was water all around. There was maybe 30 cars. People are stuck. They can't even leave unless they want to wade, you know, through waist-deep water for blocks and blocks for somebody to pick them up. And this is just happening all over. No one ever conceived that this could happen in Houston, Texas.
In the areas that are still above water, is it likely that if the rain continues through Wednesday or Thursday, as is forecast, eventually the water is going to be rising there, too? Are those areas going to be hit as well?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, this whole tropical system is moving off to the east-northeast, and so that's good news for Houston. So the waters are going to have to go down at some point. But these bayous haven't crested yet. You know, the Brazos River hasn't crested yet. The Colorado River hasn't crested yet farther west. And so in some areas, the water is going to continue to rise. But in other areas, we were, you know, talking to folks this morning, it has started to inch down again. So it really just depends on where you are. If you're close to a water course, it could go up. If you're not close to a water course, it could be draining this morning.
John, you mentioned earlier the Cajun Navy. Is that an informal name for search rescue?
It's the same thing that we saw in Katrina. I mean, this is such a disaster of vast proportions that officialdom can't handle it. The Coast Guard and the Texas State Guard and Houston Fire Department just don't have enough vessels to get out on the water, and you have a tremendous number of fishermen out here. I mean, half the people in Houston have boats, and they know it. They know how to use them. So they put out a call: if you've got a boat, bring it out and start making rescues. And people have really answered. So all over the place, you're seeing big pickups with trailers with their 23-foot, you know, fishing boats and their flat-bottom John boats, out helping, just volunteering.
I want to play two pieces of sound back to back from some people reporting on the scene down there. One was Rosa Flores. She's a CNN reporter, and she was surveying the scene. This is Sunday, so now we're going back a little bit. She was knee deep in water even at that point.
Take a look around me. I'm walking in downtown Houston, and you can see that I am surrounded by water. I want to start on this street over here because you can see there's a submerged vehicle. We talked to police about this. They said they rescued the individual who was in that truck.
Lester Holt of NBC was also out there, and he talked with a woman named Johanna Adame. She was talking to him from a life raft.
Everything is destroyed. We called 911, like, not even exaggerating, 50 times. Nobody answered.
John, you've talked to us about the rescue effort that's basically become a community effort. Are you seeing people, though, that seem to need help and can't get it? People on roofs, people on car tops?
No. No, I haven't seen that. They're back in the neighborhoods. We can't get back in the neighborhoods. What you're seeing is just people kind of walking around in an absolute daze with their belongings in a plastic sack. Maybe they've got a garbage sack over themselves as a poncho. And they're just kind of bewildered walking around, you know, looking for shelter, looking for a ride. And there are a lot of people that are helping out. As I said, you know, citizens who pitched in. But I mean, the fact of the matter is we are still in rescue mode. Don't even talk about recovery. The water hasn't gone down yet. They're still bringing people out of the neighborhoods. I think there are folks who've been there. Maybe they're running out of food. Maybe, you know, they need fresh water and they've just had it. And so they've decided they can't wait this thing out. They need to get out of their neighborhoods. Their neighborhoods have waist-deep water, and so they're bringing the family out. And those are the pictures you're seeing. You know, they're on, you know, inflatable kiddie pools and inner tubes, and so they're coming out to these fishing boats and letting people rescue them.
You know, it's quite telling that estimates are already out saying there's going to be $30 billion worth of homeowner damage, and this is with at least one or two days of rain left. So that certainly gives us a sense of how bad it is without the storm even being all that close to being over.
Oh, it's going to be. It's good. This is Houston's Katrina. Think that scale, and think years and years to come back, and think, you know, all of the contractors are going to come in. They're going to have to, you know, the rotting refrigerators, the sheetrock that melts, you know, strip things down to the studs, you know, rebuild. Are they going to have, you know, new flood requirements, you know, for height? I mean, they're going to have to reinvent their world down here. But right now, they're still taking people out of neighborhoods. So we're not there yet.
That's John Burnett. He's NPR's Southwest correspondent, usually based in Austin, but has been on the ground in Houston covering the storm Harvey. John, thanks for making time for us amid your reporting.
You bet, Sasha.
And joining me now from Washington is Zachary Warmbrot. He's the financial services reporter for Politico. He's been reporting on the struggle in Congress to keep the National Flood Insurance Program alive. His latest piece is headlined, Texas Republican Vows to Fight for Flood Insurance Overhaul. Zachary, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for having me.
So as we just heard from John, the aftermath of this is going to be massive cleanup and massive amounts of money needed to repair terrible flooding damage. And this is at a time when the flood insurance program is really in dire straits. Give us a sense of how precarious things are for the flood insurance program.
So this is a fight that's been brewing for several months. And if you look at it for several years over this program, the backdrop is that this program was created in the late 60s to fill a void where the private insurance market wasn't covering flood risks. And over the last several years, the program has just developed more and more debt, especially after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, Sandy, and even some of the flooding we saw last year across the country. So now it's saddled with about $25 billion in debt, and FEMA, the agency that operates it, says under the current structure, it cannot pay it back. So Congress has been debating without resolution about how to shore up this program while at the same time not putting, you know, flood insurance policies outside of the reach of homeowners.
And this is a taxpayer-subsidized program, is that right?
Yes, and it takes in claims, so it's similar to a private insurance operation from that respect. But part of the issue is that it does offer discounted rates, and so it has been paying out more money than it's been taking in, and having to go to the Treasury to borrow money.
And one of the debates, as I understand it, is that the rates are too discounted. It's basically too much of a subsidy that doesn't truly cover the risk.
That's a major problem, and that's what FEMA has been saying, is that that the agency would prefer Congress put this on a trajectory where the rates better match the market risks. Because right now, there's properties that even repeatedly flood, but keep in, getting these discounted rates, and they're, putting an outsized burden on the finances of the program.
There was a comment put on our website this morning, and the comment says, when one builds a multi-million dollar home on the coast of South Carolina, one expects the full faith and credit of the American government to bail one out when disaster hits. And that is a complaint many people have, that there's this repeated rebuilding in areas where maybe homes should no longer be built or maybe never should have been built. So is that really a key part of the debate here?
That's part of it, but there is a broader debate about affordability. I think there's a very large coalition in Congress, Republicans and Democrats, who represent coastal areas, who would tell you we're not there necessarily fighting for millionaires, but there's 5 million policyholders across the country, and there's people who if there's an escalation in rates to try to put this thing on better footing, it could really sort of hit average Americans' pocketbooks in a significant way.
Why, by the way, were private insurers not willing to get into the flood market so many years ago, which is why this program had to be created?
It's very costly, and there's a challenge in sort of planning out the risks. And you can see over, the last decades, there's only a nascent private flood insurance market.
So really, the vast majority is covered by this National Flood Insurance Program.
Absolutely.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron, partnering with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to deliver all you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste. Recycle the packaging or mail it back, postage free, and Blue Apron will recycle for you. Rediscover how fun cooking can be. Enjoy seasonally inspired recipes and explore new cuisines. No commitment. Get meals only when you want. Get your first 3 meals free plus free shipping at blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the impact Harvey is having on the National Flood Insurance Program, which was already $25 billion in debt before this storm. You can join this conversation. Let us know if you think the government should even be in the flood insurance game, on the backs of taxpayers, or should flood insurance be private? Do you think we're building homes in flood-prone areas where we shouldn't be building homes? And still with me is Politico Financial Services reporter Zachary Warmbrot, who's been covering this issue. Zachary, roughly how much of this Houston area that is now being so heavily flooded, how many of those homeowners even have house insurance? Do we know? Flood insurance.
So I got some numbers from Pew yesterday, Pew Charitable Trust, which follows this issue very closely. And they told me that based on FEMA data, there's at least 373,000 policyholders in the government insurance program, flood insurance program, in the 18 counties that are seeing major flooding in that area.
And do we know in terms of the Houston area, I think I read that maybe something like only 1 in 6 homeowners were covered by flood insurance. Do you have a sense of how much Houston is?
That could be right. I mean, you aren't required to buy flood insurance unless you're in a special flood hazard area and you have a government-backed mortgage. So not everyone is necessarily required to buy it.
So are parts of Houston required to have flood insurance and other parts not? So could it be that some people that aren't covered didn't think they needed to be and didn't need to be?
Yes, absolutely. And that's actually something that we saw last year in Baton Rouge, the Baton Rouge area, when they had historic flooding. Many of those people did not have flood insurance. So it's absolutely possible that many here don't either.
Let's listen to another piece of sound. This is a man named Aaron Mitchell. He told CNN that he walked 12 miles in the dark to Rockport, Texas, to try to find his father after the storm. And he's describing the impact of the wreckage he saw.
I lost everything. It just will wipe me out. And this is my first hurricane, so, I'm scared. This is my home.
What about your friends and family? Where are they at, man?
I don't know. There's been no cell service since Thursday, Friday. Haven't gotten a hold of anybody. If my mom and dad's watching, I'm okay.
Zachary Warmbrot, we heard him say that he lost everything. He said, it just wiped me out. That's one sense of how large the scale of claims could be afterward. If the flood insurance program is in such rough shape, what are the arguments for what it could take to make it stronger? Or what are the other alternatives to a national flood insurance program?
So the major alternative on the table right now is from Congressman Jeb Hensarling, who's actually a Dallas area congressman. And he's the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, and he's put together a bill that would make several reforms to the program, including, you know, phasing out some of the high-end properties that we talked about earlier, escalating rates so that people are paying more into the program, and then also opening the private market a bit more so it can come in and compete, which Chairman Hensarling says could potentially offer lower rates.
We have some callers who want to weigh in. Bob is calling from Millersburg, Missouri. Bob, welcome to On Point, and let us know what you think as you listen to all this.
Hi, Sasha. I believe the government should not continue to incentivize people to build in flood-prone areas. And one simple way to do that would be to only pay one claim on any given property so that if someone was damaged in a flood, they would get their check. But subsequent insurance by the federal government on that property would not be allowed. And that would, you know, people would have their money and they could leave or rebuild, but they would rebuild at their own risk.
And you're certainly hitting on a key point, which is that there are people who have submitted repeat claims for homes damage, and every time there's damage repaired or houses rebuilt, and many people think that's senseless.
I do, and I live in an area in coastal North Carolina that is currently under a flood watch, and we have hurricanes all the time there. And I speak as a minority, perhaps. I don't think we should continue to allow people to rebuild, and certainly sometimes people rebuild even larger homes than they started with. And I think science, it proves, the science is out there to say we should not be doing this, and we should get smart about that.
Bob, thank you. Thank you for that perspective. Let's go to Lynn. She's calling from Decatur, Illinois. Lynn, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. The point I wanted to make is I don't believe that the flood insurance actually covers 100% of the home's value and the contents. There is a limit on what is paid out if somebody files a claim. And I just wanted to make that point and find out if I'm right about that. Also, I live by a river. I'm high up from it, and it has never flooded, but I have purchased the flood insurance because there isn't anything available on the private market. Thankfully, I've never had to use it, and I really don't live in a floodplain, but I just also want to make the point that some of us that purchase it don't live in flood-prone areas, where we just do it out of an abundance of caution. And frankly, I would rather have my premiums raised and have the coverage than to have the program eliminated and have no alternative.
Lynn, thanks for that call. And Zachary Warmbrot of Politico, could you answer Lynn's question? When someone submits a claim, are they guaranteed to get full reimbursement for the damage endured?
No, there's actually a cap on how much they can get, and it's $250,000 for homes.
Which in many parts of the country is far, far less than the cost of the home, clearly.
Yes, and sometimes people go and buy additional insurance if they need it.
Let's bring in two more voices that will give us a sense of the pros and cons and how different people are proposing to fix this problematic national flood insurance program. Joining me from New Orleans is Caitlin Burney. She's vice president for policy and communications for the organization Greater New Orleans, and she's director of the Coalition for Sustainable Flood Insurance. That group is pushing for the national flood insurance to be reauthorized in September when its due date is up. Welcome, Caitlin.
Hi, Sasha. Thank you for having me.
And also joining me from Washington is Steve Ellis, Vice President of Taxpayers for Common Sense. He's also a member of Smarter Safer, a national coalition working to promote fiscally sound approaches to natural catastrophe policy. His group says the National Flood Insurance Program needs to be completely reformed. Steve, welcome to you, too.
Thanks a lot for having me, Sasha. Glad to be here.
Caitlin, could you start us off? Give us your argument for why you think that the National Flood Insurance should be reauthorized. And are you saying reauthorize it as is?
Sure. So I think it's in the country's best interest to begin to recognize that many communities exposed to flood risk are hubs of domestic energy production, international trade and finance, agriculture, and other nationally significant economic and defense activities. Affordable and sustainable flood insurance is an integral component of ensuring these communities continue their vital contributions to America. Bottom line, people live near water because it's where commerce happens. And so we need to reauthorize the flood insurance program in a way that enhances mitigation, improves mapping, preserves affordability, and increases program participation so that more people in less risky areas are buying flood insurance, paying into the program, building up reserves, and further reducing taxpayer exposure over the long term.
And how do you think people who don't currently have flood insurance should be enticed or incentivized into buying it?
So there's a couple of different ways we could go about doing this. The primary proposal that our coalition has put forward is to structure an opt-out at the point of sale so that when you purchase your home, you're automatically offered flood insurance. And instead of having to go out and seek a quote and find a policy on your own, it comes as part of your standard insurance package that you have to actively decline to have if you don't want to have it. So we think that's just a good way to shift the conversation around flood insurance and have folks buy in, making it one step easier. And we think that could have increased flood insurance take-up rates in Houston and in the Baton Rouge areas as well. And
but so many, you know, many people argue this is a broken system. Premiums are far too low. They essentially encourage people to build in flood-prone areas and then to rebuild in flood-prone areas once there's damage. So what do you don't think there's reform needed even on that side?
No, I definitely think there's room for reform. You know, I think if we're able to get more folks buying in, but we're able to improve mapping and use better technology that's becoming available, that would certainly help to assess and communicate risk much more strongly to people in flood-prone areas as well.
So with a mapping, you mean take a maybe perhaps more conservative look at maybe more people need to be in flood zones than currently are, so more people should be paying for insurance?
Correct. And if we're able to increase mitigation, that's ultimately the main way to reduce taxpayer exposure and get the NFIP on more financial sound financial footing would be to increase mitigation, which should definitely be considered as we consider an infrastructure package in Congress.
An example of mitigation would be what?
It could be everything from structural mitigation, things like levees and strong flood protection, to coastal restoration, to things like permeable pavement when you're talking about development in urban areas as well.
Steve Ellis, you're a believer that the current system is not working and needs major reforms. Tell us what you think needs to happen.
Well, it's pretty clear, Sasha, that the program is broken, and the fact that we're now looking at it's going to be adding more billions of dollars of debt onto the program that's already $25 billion in debt, likely have to increase the borrowing limit, which is currently set at $30 billion. So I think it's pretty evident just on the plain facts that this is broken. And part of it is that we need to deal with some of the cross subsidies that are in the program that, you know, people are getting subsidized rates, whether they actually need them to purchase flood insurance or not. Certainly we would agree that you need to have some means-tested assistance if people's, as their rates go up to a more risk-based level. Actually need that, but it should be outside the rate structure. Currently, we mask that risk, don't have that real risk communication tool of a higher rate. And then also, as you get higher rates, we've already seen some of the private insurers coming into the market. I'm not going to say that it's huge, but there are 20 companies, for instance, in Florida who are writing private first-dollar private flood insurance. And we want to see that develop because, like Caitlin, we want to see more people getting flood insurance. It just doesn't have to be through the NFIP, but clearly more Americans need to be covered. And if they're not, they're going to get a small disaster assistance check and really not be able to rebuild their home.
Steve, how high do you think premiums need to go up?
To where they're actually close to an actuarial rate. They're a risk-based rate. I mean, it's going to be depend on the particular property. But, you know, to Lynn's call earlier, and Zachary mentioned this, I mean, the maximum you can insure a property is $250,000 plus $100,000 for contents. And so, you know, what we heard after the 2012 reauthorization were people talking about a $40,000 rate or something crazy like that.
An annual premium of $40,000?
Right. But I never saw
which for most people would just simply be not even realistic at all.
Right. Absolutely. But beyond that, I would just point out that if you have a $40,000 rate on a maximum $250,000 property, we need to not just talk about the rate, we need to talk about the risk and that what we're subsidizing you to be in that level of a risky place. And so I think that's part of the conversation. And I would get to also Caitlin's comment about mitigation, although I will argue that levies are not, structural things are not mitigation. But anyway, but the other parts of mitigation, that's the way to really deal with rate issues, is we should be reducing rates by reducing risk, not by subsidies.
But I think we can agree that for most people, $40,000 annual insurance premium, few people, if anyone's going to buy that. I did see a proposal that one proposal would cap premiums at $10,000. Do you feel like that's more in the realm of possibility?
And that's actually in Chairman Hensarling, the Dallas Republican that Zachary mentioned earlier, in his package. Our concerns with that is that there were already amendments in the committee that were going to chop that down to about $5,000. And at some point, you're not really talking about insurance if you're capping rates. You're not talking about dealing with the risk and actually working with people to alleviate that risk, both individuals and communities. I certainly agree $40,000 is not affordable. I also don't know if there was evidence of that really occurring.
But for people who might, say, be paying a few $100 a year now, are you saying really it needs to be a few thousand? And if they're paying a few thousand, it may need to be many thousands more for this thing to be affordable?
It needs to be risk-based. We need to be charging people the level of risk and then to mitigate that or to pay out so we can have a solvent problem. Or else I'll tell you that eventually there will be Congress will throw up its hands and the program will go away. I mean, this is something where, you know, used to be argued that there was really no problems in the program, and then you had the storms of 2005 and the program's $18 billion in debt. Then you had Superstorm Sandy and the program is $24 billion in debt. Then even last year, the program still couldn't pay out the claims when you only had, and no disrespect to the people who were affected by the flooding and the rains last year, you had Hurricane Matthew, and the program still had to borrow money from the Treasury. And then you're looking at what's happening with Harvey. It's going to be even more borrowing. And at some point, you've got 5 million policyholders in this program. You've got millions of more Americans who are funding it. And so we have to figure out ways to make this more financially sustainable.
Let's go to some callers. Nicole is calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. Nicole, let us know what you think about the flood insurance situation in the U.S.
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I live in St. Petersburg, Florida, which obviously has flood issues and hurricane issues. And I kind of feel like it does need to be more risk-based. I have seen people that have these $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 homes in a flood zone where they're in canoes every year because of rain, and the prices of the insurance don't really seem appropriate. And, you know, we are in the midst of climate change, and it's predicted that these storms are going to continue and possibly be stronger. So as a Florida resident, I'm concerned about that. And when I bought my home, I specifically looked at flood zones.
Tried to avoid one?
Yes, absolutely. Because climate change, it's something that I planned when I bought my home.
Nicole, thanks for that. That's an interesting perspective, and it makes me wonder how many people are really taking the climate change factor into consideration when they look for homes. And I'm guessing you're in the minority, so thank you for that. Zachary Warmbrod of Politico, could you weigh in there and let us know how much do you think we need to take a careful look at where homes are, and people who might actually think they're not flood-prone might need a tough wake-up call and realize you are, especially as weather patterns change, and therefore you're going to have to insure or pay more money for your insurance?
I mean, that's a big issue that's on the table as Congress works this out. I mean, there's been one of the unifying factors of various people working on this is we need to improve the mapping and make it more accurate. And then, you know, there's also a push out there to try to be more transparent about what kind of discounts people are receiving on their rates. So I think there is a push to better lay this out for prospective homeowners and customers of the program.
Real quickly, why do some people get discounts on rates? What might make you qualify for that?
If a flood map changes and you don't want to pay a higher rate, you can be what's called grandfathered into your original rate.
Ah, so they don't lose you because even though the area you live in has become more risky, they want to entice you to keep your insurance.
Right.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the fiscally and politically controversial National Flood Insurance Program. Join this conversation. Let us know if you believe we should rethink how we offer flood insurance. Should it be mandated? Should it be automatically included in a homeowner's policy? Should it not be a government-subsidized program? Do you think premiums should go up or should they go down? I'm talking with Zachary Warmbrot, a financial services reporter at Politico, Caitlin Burney, director of the Coalition for Sustainable Flood Insurance, and Steve Ellis, vice president of Taxpayers for Common Sense and a member of Safer Smarter. I want to start us off with a piece of sound. This is the FEMA administrator, Brock Long. And on Sunday, he told NBC's Meet the Press that FEMA is ready to process claims through the National Flood Insurance Program immediately.
We have well over 1,000 people in the field ready to administer that program. That's part of the workforce laydown that we have in Texas right now. We're already mobilizing. We're encouraging people to reach out to their local insurance policy holders and begin, you know, starting the process as soon as they start to experience flood damage.
We've gotten a number of fairly cynical comments on our website. One person says, how many wake-up calls do coastal cities located where hurricanes churn need to get back to the drawing board? Another person says, don't build in a flood zone. It ain't hard. And if you do, don't expect a taxpayer bailout. Caitlin Burney, tell us again, we have so many people critical of this system. And I'm interested in your sense of, I mean, you basically say we do need some changes, but there seems to be such a majority feeling that the system as is broken. Tell me why you think it doesn't need a radical overhaul.
So I think the system, if you look at the balance book of the NFIP, up until Hurricane Katrina, it was more or less operating in the black. And the main driver of the Hurricane Katrina debt is due to a failure of the Army Corps of Engineers levee system here around the New Orleans area. The program was simply not set up to cover the failure of that federal infrastructure. But the program more or less was operating in the black, with the exception of these outlier years like Katrina and then Sandy and now Harvey. But these are all events that are happening in New York City, New Orleans, and Houston, economic engines for this entire country. And so, you know, I think it's really easy for folks who don't live in floodplains to say, why are people building down here? Why are people building in flood-prone areas? I'll go back to the point, this is where commerce happens. These are all cities that have been here for 300 years. And to expect that people are going to simply, you know, move some of the largest economies in the country is just not realistic. So we, again, need to go back to thinking about how we recognize the fact that our areas are flood-prone, but that they're critical to America's economy, and talk about ways to really improve mitigation and to enhance flood risk reduction in our country.
Steve Ellis, what's happening in Houston may be an example of what Caitlin Burney is talking about. You know, Houston is massive. I think, what, the fourth largest city in the country, possibly? And we can't really tell people you just can't live there anymore. Is that a practical solution? Or how would you rebut what Caitlin says?
Well, I think, you know, one thing is that she's absolutely right that the program sort of went in the red, went in the black, back and forth up until 2005. But then to say, well, 2005 was an exception, but then Sandy was an exception, but then Harvey's an exception, you know, we got to realize that this program is not working. Last year was the third largest risk loss year for the program in its history, and they had to borrow for Hurricane Matthew. So, and you're absolutely right. Houston is the fourth largest city in the country. There are going to be people living there. Humans are attracted to water, whether it's commerce or not. That's a human nature. But then it means that we have to be smarter about how we rebuild. It has to be smarter about how we encourage people in development. So some of it is not just about NFIP. It's even about the federal disaster policies. And are we paying people to rebuild pretty much in the same way, and not just individual homeowners, but also the communities and how they zone and they lay out the land. And so are they taking into account impervious areas that are increasing flood risks? So I think we have to look at this holistically as well. And I think that also one of the ways, one of the tools we have is informing people of their risk by knowing what the actual cost is of having this insurance, of having the federal government on the hook. And then also that will help develop the private marketplace, and we can shift more of this risk off of the taxpayer and onto the private marketplace. One thing that's a good thing that came out of the last reauthorization is that FEMA, by Congress's direction, went out and purchased reinsurance, which is essentially in the private marketplace insurance for insurance companies. And so once they hit a $4 billion loss in this Harvey, $1 billion of the additional cost is going to be picked up by the private sector. We could be doing more of that and shedding more of the risk onto the private sector.
Let's hear from some more callers. Robert is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Robert, welcome to On Point.
Hi. So I also have a home, in a very modest home in Burlington, Vermont, in the backwater of the Winooski River. And in 2011, we had Hurricane Irene, but before Hurricane Irene, Lake Champlain had obliterated its record, and it was about a foot and a half deeper than it was ever known to be in history, just simply from the snowmelt that spring. And my home suffered flooding just from rising water. So it wasn't rushing water. It wasn't like these hurricanes, like Hurricane Irene in Vermont or this, where water was coming and just carrying somebody's home away and destroying it. But the water got high enough that it came within about 5 inches from covering my first floor. And had it covered my first floor, it would have pretty much destroyed the house. It would have made it non-economical to try to replace it.
And did you have flood insurance?
I did not have flood insurance, and since this, I did not purchase flood insurance, because here's why. At one time, we were paying a mortgage, and then we needed to have flood insurance, and we were paying about $1,500 a year for flood insurance. And for the 10 years that I lived in the house, that would have been $15,000. And when this, the lake obliterated its record by being a foot and a half deeper than it's ever been known to be, I suffered about maybe $10,000 of damage. And the insurance would have had a $5,000 deductible. And so I would have paid $15,000 into this program and received only $5,000 of support coming out of it after the worst thing that could have happened to me happened to me. I just don't consider that to be a valuable, I don't consider that to be a good investment.
I want to note something you said, which is that some people may not realize that if you don't have a mortgage, if you're fortunate enough to have paid it off or to have bought a house in cash, you're not required. It's only when you're a mortgage holder that the requirement kicks in. If you don't have a mortgage and choose not to get one, you're basically rolling the dice. Robert, thank you for that. Let's also hear from Chase calling from Palm Beach, Florida. Chase, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for taking my call, Sasha. I am almost totally on board with the previous caller. My partner and I work in professions that I'm a nurse, and we can work wherever we go. But I lived in Indiana and worked in Indiana temporarily in 2008, where I lived in a town for only 8 days, and it was destroyed by a flood. Now, I'm a Floridian, but had managed to avoid all that. Ironically.
I was going to say the irony, you leave Florida, go to Indiana, and then you're flooded.
Well, right. And then with the other caller from St. Petersburg, I'm going to have to remind her, we can't be naive about this. We cannot pretend it's not going to happen. Our financial planner, actually, with what the previous caller from Vermont had said, we go naked, basically. Our financial planner told us, don't carry flood insurance. It's an economic loser because we haven't, you know, it's $7,000 a year for us. And we live in a very modest home. We're working people. And luckily we can take our jobs anywhere. Thank heaven for that. But, as far as I face one of the wealthiest neighborhoods, in the world, Palm Beach, the town of Palm Beach, and those people's homes, they get insurance that they can afford for $10, $15 million properties. And we don't think it's fair that we're actually paying for that too, but we're not even able to carry insurance of our own.
Chase, thank you for that. Zachary Wormbrot, could you weigh in briefly? I mean, is for some people, are they making a sound decision when they say it's just not worth the money?
I think that's a big issue. I mean, if you look at the floods in Baton Rouge last year, and I mentioned this earlier, many of those people did not have flood insurance. So I think there is a case to be made, especially by members who are trying to preserve the affordability of this program, that we need to do things to incentivize more people to buy it. Senator John Kennedy, who's one of the most outspoken voices on this, has said, you know, if you get 20 inches of rain in 3 days anywhere, you're going to flood. I don't care if you're on Pikes Peak. I mean, that might be debatable, but that's how some people are framing it.
Zachary Wormbrot, financial services for reporter for Politica. Thanks for joining us this hour. Also, thanks to Caitlin Burney, she's director of the Coalition for Sustainable Flood Insurance, and to Steve Ellis, vice president of Taxpayers for Common Sense and member of Smarter Safer. Thanks to all three of you. We're now going to turn to the impact that Tropical Storm Harvey is having on oil refineries and the price of gasoline. Joining me to talk about that is Nathan Bomey. He's a business reporter for USA Today. He wrote a piece yesterday headlined, "Here's How Much Hurricane Harvey is Driving Up Gas Prices." Welcome to On Point, Nathan. And what's the answer to that? How much is the hurricane driving up gas prices?
Hey, thanks for having me. You know, it depends on where you live in the country, but the impact could be up to about 25 cents per gallon. If you haven't seen it already, it's probably coming, and that's because wholesale gas prices are a leading indicator of retail prices, and wholesale is moving up. So, you know, that's obviously because the refineries in the Houston and Corpus Christi area that have had to shut down because of the incredible flooding and of course, the storm damage have, you know, left basically this region with shortages. And so, likely we will see that in the next couple days if it isn't already happening in your area.
And just as a real basic question, remind us, I mean, we're talking about the Gulf Coast being a major petrochemical center, huge area of oil chemical production. Talk to us about how much of that area drives that industry.
Yeah, this is significant. I mean, and this is an energy-rich area. Obviously, the energy economy drives Houston in many respects. And so, you know, the refinery business in particular, about, you know, more than 10% of the nation's capacity is actually there in the Houston area, which is obviously significant. And so, you know, with many major facilities having to shut down temporarily, including Exxon's facility in Baytown, for example, which is one of the biggest in that area, this is, you know, a significant impact. Because, you know, ultimately, you know, had the storm gone a little bit to one way or another, perhaps the impact could have been muted. But because Houston is so heavily dependent on refining and oil production, this is really, you know, was sort of a worst case scenario. That said, of course, you know, 25 cent increase on the gallon of gas is not going to break the bank for a lot of people, since price is already low. So that's, I guess, suppose, you know, for people who are, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, you know, I don't think that this is going to break the bank necessarily, but certainly this is not, this is an unexpected cost for a lot of folks.
I also read that price hikes in gas could vary depending on where in the country you are. Why would there be regional differences in how much price increase you'd see?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And so gas, you know, moves basically from this area to the Midwest in particular and through pipelines and such to other areas of the country. But I think the Midwest will be particularly hard hit. We're looking at maybe up to 25 cents a gallon there. I think obviously the Gulf Coast, that, you know, goes without saying, there'll be increases there. There could be some shortages, for example, in certain areas of Texas where gas stations may not be able to get the gasoline that they need because of basically freight issues and shipping problems there. I think the Northeast will definitely see a, you know, an increase of maybe 10 to 15 cents a gallon. The West, probably not as big of an impact because not as much of the refining capacity ends up going out west, but certainly there will be a little bit of an impact there as well.
And so is the issue that the refineries are either damaged or were shut down as a precaution, and that ends up creating a hiccup in supply?
Yeah, right now it's a little bit too early to say exactly how much long-term damage there could be. I think that there is an indication that there may not be a lot of long-term damage because the wind wasn't as big of a factor as the rain. That said, I think that we'd be fooling ourselves if we believed there was no long-term damage here. So as the water subsides, some of those assessments will start to occur. And I think, I'm sure there will be some, but at least at the moment it looks like it won't be widespread permanent damage, which, of course, could lead to long-term increases in gas prices. But right now, there is one sort of saving grace for motorists right now, which is that we are coming to the end of the summer driving season. And so gas prices typically fall in early September anyways. And so demand obviously falls off because people aren't traveling as much anymore. Back to school, of course, puts a stop to a lot of travel. So that would naturally actually usually send prices lower at this time of year. And so we're actually seeing the reverse of that, but those economics will catch up at some point.
You just touched on what I wanted to ask next, which is if we do see a price hike, how do we know when that price hike may subside? What would the factors be? Would it be, for example, however long it takes to repair or reopen damaged refineries?
I think so, yes. I think as soon as those refineries can get back online, then we'll start to see the gas prices likely come back down. Of course, you know, it's sometimes it's always hard to say with any specificity exactly how gas prices will flow, since it's sometimes anybody's guess. But I think that 1 to 3 weeks probably will likely see things return back to normal. But again, if there is unexpected long-term damage, for example, at the Baytown facility that Exxon runs, that's a significant plant. And if there is long-term damage there, then that could affect things. But, you know, there are other refineries. Another issue here is shipping channels, the Houston Shipping Channel, which is a major route through which a lot of this gasoline moves. If the outage there that's currently in place continues for longer, then that could also lead to higher increases for longer times. So we'll see. But I think 1 to 3 weeks is your best bet for how long these increases will last.
Do you have a sense, Nathan, of what the larger impact on the larger Houston economy will be? We're talking specifically about gas and oil. There are obviously other industries there. Any sense of the long-term impact on what Houston and its business climate looks like after this?
Well, you know, in terms of the impact on individuals, obviously it's massive, in tens of billions of dollars of damage that we've discussed at length. That, you know, and of course, you already discussed some of the insurance implications there, and there's no doubt that the personal impact is devastating. In terms of the impact on the on businesses in this area, you know, one to look at would be the automotive sales, for example. Edmunds is projecting this morning probably a 2% decline in auto sales in August nationwide because of what's happening in Texas. Now,
because cars are produced down there?
Because cars are sold in high quantities in the Houston area, which of course is a major, you know, population center for the country, and so actually that alone is enough to drag down the numbers for August.
A lot to assess. Nathan Bomey, business reporter for USA Today. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to do it. Thank you.
And listeners, you can join the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.